Well, welcome everyone to another episode of AI and Healthcare series sponsored by Stanford Online. And we are just absolutely thrilled to have our guest today, Dr. Eric Topol. He really needs no introduction, but you may recognize him. He's the founder of Scripps Research Translational Institute and executive vice president at Scripps Research. He's a major voice in AI, genomics, and precision medicine, and a prolific author of Deep Medicine, The Patient Will See You Now, and of course, his new book, Super Agers, talking about longevity. And we're going to talk a little about that today. He's also just generally an awesome colleague and friend and an advocate for tech-enabled healthcare, and I think has done a lot, at least for me in my career. I'm sure, Justin, you agree, inspiring us to really lean in and try to spread the word about the things that we know are happening in technology and how they may impact healthcare. So welcome, Eric. Thanks for being here.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Matt and Justin. Well, I know we'll have a fun conversation.
Well, one of the first things I was curious about was how do you do it all? How do you get all these pieces done? How do you write all that you do, speak all that you do? And the context being, there's this, New Yorker article that came up recently of, are you just cheating your way through college using AI from a recent headline? And we can talk about some of the educational pieces, but how do you do it all? And then we can talk about the education piece in a second.
Well, it's kind of a combination of being two things. One is being an infovore, just trying to ingest lots of information, and then the other being a lunatic. I don't have any secret. You can ask my wife of 46 years; she'll tell you that I'm a lunatic. So, yeah.
Well, so, I mean, but this is like, have you? I mean, you've been doing this for a long time, and again, I feel like I've been following your work. And Justin and I, we kind of try to bridge. We try to stay up on healthcare and AI, obviously in our day jobs, but then it's also our, I would say, our passions as well. When we see this technology kind of coming, I keep running into evidence, kind of what Justin was just showing. Hey, this is really, really good. This technology is really, really good at, tutoring you on a subject, at your education, your grade level, whatever it is. I don't hear about folks using it for that much, and I have to admit, I've just started to try to, like, have a conversation with the model about maybe a new concept or a new paper. I wasn't doing that as much, and I feel like I'm missing out on some of the capabilities of the models to uplevel my own skill set and try to get my arms around all the new things that keep coming. I don't know how you have approach this technology in your own personal work life, but it seems like a lot of folks aren't really using it for that purpose.
Yeah, I don't think people generally appreciate, and even I'm sure a lot of your listeners, how extraordinary capabilities are. And it just keeps getting better, like on a weekly, whatever basis. It's just, you want to do generate a report on a topic, it could take weeks, and here you have it in, a matter of minutes. And you want to, in the case of healthy aging and promoting the super ager story, the data across so many different layers at an individual level that no human would ever be able to assimilate. But here you have models that will do that. So the capabilities are just so powerful. And I just keep getting blown away. I mean, first we all had the Chat GPT moment in November of 22. Some months ago I started using notebook LM and saw podcasts being generated, from up to 50 PDFs, to, I mean, what? The kinds of things you can do now are mind-blowing. And I don't think most people realize that because they just haven't, been, testing it. And more, there's more awareness. Oh, confabulations and errors and propagation of biases and all sorts of things like that. But not enough awareness of the power. I mean, it's just beyond comprehension. People talk about, have we achieved artificial superintelligence or AGI? And I recently talked with Tyler Cowen, who said, look, this is it. I know porn when I've seen it, and this is it, And I mean, I don't know. It doesn't really matter what it is, but it's a lot.
Well, we've had this discussion, Justin, in other episodes too, about like the capabilities are moving so quickly that it's I'm not sure I would know if we cross whatever line we're talking about for that moment of AGI and AES. Like, I mean, there's right. It seems like there's
Yeah.
just so much we can do with what's already here. And then when it comes to like interacting with the models in a education kind of way, like this is the like what does this mean for like healthcare in general, like how we train physicians and all the, I don't think we've really gotten our arms around this. And I think, as folks are starting to use this in their, high school and undergrad, and what happens in med school? Like, are we still really going back to sitting in classes? And, we all know the data on retention from live lectures and all this stuff. Are we really still going to do that? Or are we going to have to reinvent this? And I know, you're involved, both Jess and I too, in educating the next generation. Like, I'm not sure how to incorporate this into the curriculum.
Yeah, it's a great question. I gave the commencement address at Mount Sinai last week at their med school. So it made me think more, with kind of at the moment, things are so dynamic. What's it going to be for a medical school? And it's going to have to undergo some radical changes. And the whole idea of memorizing stuff and the what would constitute the curriculum today is already outdated terribly. There's no AI in the curriculum, which is amazing,
I
right?
know.
I mean, wow. I mean, not that we want every, physician to be a computer scientist, but they should at least feel very grounded, facile, comfortable, understand the nuances and limitations. And there isn't a medical school yet today, which is embarrassing, at 150 plus in this country that has really gotten this into their curriculum. So a lot has to change there. Also, selecting who's going to be a doctor.
Yeah.
Doesn't have to be the GPA and the MCAT score anymore. We really want to get people who are exuding the most human and humanistic qualities. So we don't do that very well right now. We're not breeding people for those qualities as much as we need to in the future.
Where do you think we are, in medical education or even healthcare more broadly? Because you have these conversations with leaders all across the country, you're invited to go speak with them. What do you think is the current understanding of the capabilities of the technology at the leaders of healthcare across the country today? Do they, obviously, Matt and I are on, and you are on one end of the spectrum of what we think this technology is doing and reading and keeping up. But where is the average healthcare leader of a medical school as well as a, health system today in your mind?
I think it's the earliest phase. So, it's being considered for, back office operations for coding and things like that, and operations, but also, maybe for trying to get the ambient conversations and reduction of keyboard and data clerk work for clinicians. But it isn't far-reaching at all. There isn't the interest of getting patients empowered and charged to do more with their data. There isn't really wide-scale implementation. It's mainly in images related, and there isn't any multimodal AI that's really made its way through regulatory that's got into a health system at this point. So that's where everything is right now in terms of the excitement. It's going to take a while. The problem, I think, that is driving the slowness, which is characteristic of the medical community. I've always thought it's been sclerotic or ossified, right? But what really is the lack of compelling data. So, I mean, if we just go back to imaging, which has several year history now, you've got studies of over 100,000 women in Sweden were randomized, where the mammogram interpreted with a radiologist and AI was clearly superior. picking up 25% more breast cancer and significant breast cancer and reducing the time. But what about the United States? What proportion of our mammograms are using AI with radiology readers? As an example, how long is it going to take with the most compelling data that we have to actualize it in daily practice? And we have RadNet that's charging $35 to the women. I mean, this is crazy. This should be routine. So it isn't a good precursor to seeing what I'm envisioning, which is, super agers and the future of health span. I do think we're going to get there, but it takes much too long when the opportunities are so remarkably great.
And there's something to that, right? So, like, while we are, well, and for probably a whole laundry list of reasons which we could go into, but just why we're laggards and why a lot of this stuff has been challenging. While that's going on, consumers, our patients, have access to literally the greatest AI technology on the planet, on their phones and on their laptops. And Justin, I don't know if you have that quote from the. There's now, there's anecdotal, evidence everywhere where folks are putting in their medical data into the models on their consumer, on their consumer, app, and they're getting in some cases some pretty powerful results. And this is leading folks to say, well, now, if the patient is able to use this powerful technology, and achieve, a health outcome or a diagnosis. And they do that independent of the physician who decided not to use that or cannot use that. This was a comment from of a malpractice attorney in an article, very provocative thought. But the position that he's kind of promoting here is that, listen, it's negligence. If you there's a tool that is better, better for patient care if you could use it, and you choose not to use it. Is, I think that's a very interesting. Th this has never happened before, to my knowledge. Like, there was never, like, someone did such an amazing Google search that, it could, make some, really, really powerful diagnoses that the physician may have overlooked or that seemed much further away. But now we have literally a model that's going to, reason over your healthcare data, find connections, and potentially, give you a d answer that, maybe your clinician couldn't do.
Oh
Anyway, it
man,
just
it's
it's a
happening
fascinating.
every day. I know. Today, in the Wall Street Journal, there was a young fellow who wrote about how he was disabled and he used Claude, Anthropic's prompting with all his data. He had all this sensor data, and it fixed him. I mean, it's like, wow. After he'd seen several specialists and whatnot. I mean, it's a common story we're seeing now. And we're going to see a lot more of that. But unfortunately, the medical system doesn't support individuals to have more control. They want to control everything, right? They don't even want to have all their data. I mean, it's their data, but they only can get a portal a access, and even that's limited, right? So this is a real imbalance that shouldn't be tolerated. But we don't see enough of health systems that are promoting AI in their patient base. I mean, another re striking example is the first multimodal AI for patients. Besides, we go back to the diagnosis of arrhythmia through a smartwatch, right? But more recently, the diagnosis of sudden death through a smartwatch, FDA cleared. It could save lives that if people are have that watch with an app and they keel over and it brings the paramedics to their to them immediately. I mean, that's amazing, right? So yeah, there's also, and that's obviously a multimodal story of detecting pulselessness without, and motionless and, having a baseline. So there's the opportunities here are just extraordinary. They're limitless. And we need to give patients more charge. They're eager to have it. It has to be, practical and expensive, well proven. It's easier to move the patient side than it is the clinical side.
So it's interesting you bring up that piece on consumer empowerment and consumers going to find this information. And it's interesting this week, I'm actually out here in Washington, D.C. right now, where we've had a bunch of announcements
But relevant to this on, an RFI from CMS talking about wanting for more exchange of data, wanting for more, consumer access to that. And then a real call for technology, candidly, in a way I haven't seen before from administrations coming in here. And so it seems like there's pressure on that side. The other thing actually I'll pull up, which was some interesting examples of private companies starting to take a more aggressive view towards empowering consumers. And I was hoping to find more talk about this in your book, but what's
No.
happening now of a kind of controversial within medicine of, hey, we're just going to scan healthy people. And, now using AI, we can do it faster. We can look for more, as well as run tons of blood tests,
Yeah.
combine AI on top of that. And it's clear investors are super excited about this as a concept. And so, with these companies combining to do all of this together, and so how are you
Yeah.
putting those pieces together?
Well, it is in my super ager's book, and it isn't good about doing funk a total body MRI, I can assure you. This is a bad thing to have for healthy people because it's a recipe for false positives. And I've already seen patients who, for example, had a liver nodule, then they had a biopsy and they almost bled to death, and or had a pneumothorax from a chest nodule. All these are like benign things that are being found by total body MRI. And I just did a podcast with Mark Hyman, who is the co-founder of Function, and they just acquired Ezra, the second largest purveyor of total body MRIs. They reduced the cost and reduce the time. So what? It shouldn't be done. And I made it clear that none of these tests should be done unless there's a good reason that it's a person's risk. And finding a cancer in a mass on a scan is not as appealing as finding it at a microscopic level before it ever shows up on a scan. And we can do that in patients. So one of the three major age-related diseases that I go through in super agers is cancer. We can get ahead of cancer. It takes 20 years for most cancers to fully take hold and get to a point of metastasis. Well, if we use a person's electronic health record, structured, unstructured text, if we get set points of their labs, that is, labs in the normal range, but trending in the wrong direction that we can't see because we're just looking at normal or abnormal. And if you add to that, the cancer susceptibility genes, the pathogenic mutations, the gene whole genome sequence, the polygenic risk score, and then things like a methylation clock, organ clocks. You can get to the point, I know this person's high risk for this type of cancer. And then if that person, irrespective of age, you might get a tumor DNA sample of the plasma, so-called liquid biopsy. And only then, if the AI of that doesn't tell us where the organ is, then you would get a total body MRI. But right now, everything is all screwed up. You got promoting functions, and many other companies are selling, including particularly Pronovo, selling total body MRI to wealthy people. With no data, right? And in the book, I go through Dhruv Kular's case, which he's a New Yorker writer and a great physician at Cornell, and he goes along with getting a free total body MRI. Guess what happens to him in his 40s, healthy guy? They find a prostate abnormality. Now he has to get prostate biopsies every 6 months. Don't sign me up for that. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, and his life is completely been affected by that. And there's a great quote by a colleague in the book about it. Look, this is terrible. This is predatory, predatory. And we shouldn't let this happen. But it's unregulated jungleoid space. It's great to have MRIs cheaper and quicker. Who wants to go hang out as a patient in an MRI machine? But use it for the right people. And it's just like mass screening for cancer. We have everybody treated like cattle. right? All the same. Just, if you're a woman, you go for your mammogram. 88% of women will never have cancer. Why do we put all of them through this and have so many false positives and false negatives? So everything we do is so dumb and wasteful. And it just is what it's doing. What it's really good at is getting people anxious for no reason. And it's just, we got to do better than this. It's really, I wrote a long Substack on these 12 longevity, quote, longevity companies. And there's not much there. I do think they're on the right track that they want to get better data on people. But when they promote things with no proof, that's where I draw the line. Because we do have proof for a lot of things and we're not using it.
Tell us more about that side. And I know you got to see a bunch of really positive things. I love your synopsis of the book of lifestyle plus of areas of kind of it's great because I think we all have this conversations with family members, colleagues, friends. Hey, what would you recommend for these things? It's a beautiful synopsis, I think, of what you said of the highest quality evidence things. But talk to us just about a few of those and how you see AI playing a role in that in a positive way.
So, I mean, we don't get people to, again, here we are prescribing the same lifestyle for all people, and not just diet, sleep, exercise. You got many other layers of that. That's why I call it lifestyle plus. Anyway, that doesn't work that well. You need to have that at an individual level. And who's likely to adopt these things? It's people who know they're at risk. And they're at risk, way in advance. And we have this opportunity we've never had before for primary prevention. I mean, this has been a fantasy for millennia in medicine that we would prevent diseases from ever occurring. We don't do that today, but we can. Now, lifestyle is a big way to do it. And that is, I think, once we get into this, that you accept that there's these three age-related diseases, not that we're trying to reverse aging. We're accepting aging. We just want to prevent the diseases that are pegged to aging process. Very different lean, different position. At any rate, so once you have these three, then the lifestyle factors are common for all. If exercise, is as essential, if paramount, if not, if there's one thing. And it's not just aerobic, it's resistance and strength and balance. I mean, all these things are critical as we get older. The diet is, very important. Not to have a pro-inflammatory diet, ultra-processed food, lots of red meat, things that we know are not good for you for that. And then, of course, sleep, getting deep sleep when we clear these waste products from our brain that are just bad. We got to get them out of there. We need more deep sleep as we get older. And we can track it now easily. With a smartwatch, with a ring, and pretty accurately. So those are some fundamentals. There's many other layers, but once you know you're at risk for, let's say, Alzheimer's, 20 years in advance, and you know things can help, and you get a p-tau 217 biomarker, which is would be abnormal 20 years in advance. That's what's amazing, and it responds to exercise and lifestyle, and you can bring it down 40, 50, 70%. You're motivated now. You can see your lifestyle kicking in just like you would LDL cholesterol with a statin. So this is what makes these three diseases, and each has their own strategy, like I mentioned, p-tau 217 and other neuro inflammation markers, right? This is a unique time in medicine. We've never had this. We had to have the AI to integrate all the data. And we had to have the organ clocks and these biomarkers and liquid biopsies and all these things. We didn't have those until recent times, some very recent time. That's why we're so set up right now. It's a convergence of the science of aging with the advances in large language models and large reasoning models.
Yeah, this is so spot on, I think. How AI is kind of coming in at the right time in a lot of different ways, but for this in particular, it's kind of again ties back to what we were saying about consumer empowerment. But it's not just about, hey, Let's throw you in as many, scans as possible. And it's collecting the right data. It's addressing some of the things that we know are evidence-based that are, leading to chronic disease, and, tied to healthy aging, those behaviors. But there's also an aspect of this too that you also mentioned, which I'm just seeing a lot more. I feel maybe it's just, confirmation bias. I feel like there's a lot more interest when you hear about AI drug discovery and identifying, ways to now address some of these age-related processes. And again, I'm not saying there's the fountain of youth in a pill, although I'm sure there's startups that will be pitching that. But there is some aspect of this that now that we have a better understanding of the surface area of the things that we know are like definite contributors to disease, are we now able to look at the therapeutic side? And does AI also help us there? And again, this is it, my crystal ball is a little foggy in this space, but it does seem like with this rapid ability to identify targets and identify functions, and now that we're pointing it at things that are related to longevity, talk about that a little bit, because I know that you touch on this in your book, and it's just an area that I don't know if I understand well enough, and I haven't seen, I guess the sort of breakthrough that maybe I would expect already.
Yeah, I think it's coming. I mean, I think the ability to identify targets and project their efficacy and safety profile, I mean, that's all going to accelerate. There aren't that many great examples yet, but I think we'll see them. And even, not just predicting protein structure 3D at high resolution, but designing the proteins and small molecules and antibodies and the all the biomolecules. So that's in the works. But what I think is something to get some perspective is the GLP-1 drugs. All right. So this a whole chapter on that. And if we would go back 20 years ago, when they Novo Nordisk only wanted to develop this for diabetes. And if they had asked AI, should we look at it for obesity? I quipped in the book, yeah, they should. The AI would have told them, but it took a human to keep pressing them there in Denmark, Lotte Knudsen, for years. We got to try this for obesity. We got to try it. And it's amazing because the reason they didn't want to do it is because people with diabetes didn't lose any weight, like 3 or 4 pounds. People with obesity lost 40, 50, 80 pounds. We still don't know why. And I even asked AI why, and it didn't give me an answer, right? Nobody knows why. There's theories, right? There's lots of theories, like why do women live longer than men? Nobody knows that either, really. Anyway, this is we are in a time when all these gut hormones, we're just getting started. If you think that these drugs are, miracle drugs like, Ozempic and Zepbound and Mounjaro, you ain't seen nothing yet. We got triple receptors, we got pills, and we got a lot more gut hormones coming, at any rate, the gut hormones talk to the brain, they talk to our immune system, they're potent. They're well tolerated. We don't know any serious side effects, really, when you think about it. This is going to explode. And that's just talking about gut hormones, right? So no, we're just, if you guys are young, but we've been trying to crack this obesity case for, a long time,
Long
many,
time.
many decades, right? And now look at this. I mean, it's just, we got people taking these drugs just to lose, 5 pounds, so whatever. It's ridiculous. But it's amazing what's happening here. And I don't want it to continue in terms of a drug, a forever drug. I'd like to see people take advantage of this and, get off of them and be very inexpensive and keep getting better. But that should tell you we're in a new age of, drug discovery itself, just one class of drugs. And it's broad. I'm not just talking about glucagon like peptide or glucagon. I'm talking about all the gut hormones because, there's a lot of them. When I was in medical school, there weren't any gut hormones. It's insulin, Now there's, like 50 of them. Yeah.
Well, what there's almost too much to cover on kind of what's coming next and down the pipe. Like today, if a lot of I think our audience is trying to figure this out for themselves. How do they use the tools? Where do they do this? So like today, what are you using? What would be a message you would want people to take away for where they should be experimenting or using some of these tools now?
Well, I mean, I'll
But
use anything as long as it works, as long as it helps me. So I don't know that there's, getting into nitty-gritty helpful there. But I just would go back that, when the when you I think only in a tunnel vision of how can I use AI to improve health. That's what I think about. I'm obsessed with it. I've been obsessed with it for many years, and I don't know if I'll ever get over it, right? So that's what I think about, and that's why I think the next frontier is prevention. Demis Hassabis was on 60 Minutes a couple weeks ago, and he said, you will end of diseases, cure diseases within the next decade. I don't see why not, he said. And a lot of people don't think that's possible, and I don't think it's going to happen in 10 years. But we have a way forward now to use these tools and to keep improving them, so that we can really get there. And that's why we're going to have a lot more elderly people. Right now, they're the few. Then the elderly people, which are the almost all after age 60 some, we can flip that. And it's really exciting. And so that's what I keep thinking about, and that's what I'm working towards. And that's what the book Super Agers is all about.
I feel like, your obsession, we benefit from your, whether you think it's healthy or not, your obsession with health and AI, because honestly, it's laid out so clearly here in the in that framework. And again, in terms of using the different tools, I think part of it's just the fact that you encourage that folks do that. Like, I think it's important because of the accelerating pace of it's still that jagged edge, right? Like, there's still things that, hey, it's not quite there on in this one or two, these one or two areas, but yet it's so profoundly good in others. And if you, but without that intuition, it becomes hard maybe to even see where that, how that vision plays out. I know, Justin, you have that, there's a graphic where it's sort of like, what are folks starting to converge on using these models for in their day-to-day life? And it started out with like, hey, can you answer this quick question? Can you write this blog? And now look at this. This to me is fascinating. And this ties into another theme in your book, Super Agers, to me, because you see again, is it editing text, generating ideas, and this little number two category, therapy and companionship from 2024, now is the number one use. And then we have organizing my life, and then we have finding purpose. It's this, is this like sort of starting to address the idea of social isolation and loneliness as a contributor to a decline in health and wellness? And is this again another place where unexpectedly something is coming up from the technology side to fill that gap or to fill that need? And anyway, the point is I feel like folks are starting to tell us what these models are more useful for to them in their daily lives. And it's surprising to me that it's not homework and doing my TPS reports at work, right? It's these are
Right.
things that I wouldn't have predicted, having been in technology for this long, that would be so popular.
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right, Matt. And when I wrote Deep Medicine, I wrote that the machines will never help with empathy. I couldn't have been more wrong, right? Because now there's like 12 studies to show that patients perceive empathy from machines more better than their doctors. I mean, what? How could this be? That's of course, doctors are rushed, and machines don't even know what empathy is, but they can transmit it. They can be a vector for it just from having learned, been pre-trained with language. So what we're seeing is something I never would have predicted. And it's replicated many, many times through various different studies, right? So I know there's something there. It also tells us that we humans have to amp it up if we can be beaten so easily as physicians by machines, right? So, it's exciting that the unpredictable positive features that you touched on. And it isn't like we're plateauing here. We're going to keep seeing progression capabilities. And yeah, here's another graph of yours.
Yeah, and you just brought this up and it's come up a bunch of times, but I think what I certainly didn't predict was that for much longer, I thought AI plus human performance would beat out AI on some of these diagnostic tasks. And this was another, actually, Matt, do you want to give some more context on this benchmark from OpenAI this week on their evaluation set? Showing again, actually, these models now can start to perform better without humans tweaking.
Yeah, this is it's called Health Bench. It was released by OpenAI, right? A nice contribution, if I'm being honest, to the broader community, because it is open source data set. 5,000+ conversations, a couple hundred physicians on simulated medical questions from 60 countries, almost, I think it's around 50 languages, and across, dozens and dozens of medical specialties. And then they do these really full evaluations. And again, I think it's meant to be sort of a nice new thing for the community to think about as they evaluate the medical performance of these models, as opposed to step one was hard, and I am impressed that these models do well, but as we've saturated those benchmarks, I think we all recognize that maybe that's not the ultimate goal of leveraging these models to do medical type tasks. And so this one I think is slightly more realistic. I would say some of the great work that Nigam Shah's group has done at Stanford in MedHelm, another way to sort of take real world medical data and turn those into benchmarks and then be able to rate and rank the different models. But it's just another example, though, where I think part of this is just not, I still hold out faith despite, being, accused of being on the Vinod side of the spectrum on some of this. I still believe that physicians with these tools, if we can figure out how that relationship is ultimately symbiotic in a good way, I think it's going to be awesome. But right now it still feels like we're kind of at that junior high dance where doctors are on one side, AI's on the other a little bit, and we haven't figured out how to dance together to make the kind of results that we expect to see, which is together that they're better.
Yeah, it's a good metaphor with the dancing and junior high. But no, you probably know Pranav, who you know very well. Raj Perker and I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times when we commented on six studies where when AI was compared to doctors who had AI, and whether it was radiology or whether it was diagnosis or patient management, all six studies showed the AI better in performance. And that was not anticipated. As you said, Matt, there was no symbiosis there. Now, is that because doctors are not grounded with AI, even though they had it to be able to use? Is it because they have automation bias that they just don't appreciate it can help? Or is it because the studies are contrived, they're not like real world medicine? We don't know yet. I hope, like you just asserted or opined, that we're going to get there, that we will get the best of both worlds, but we don't have evidence for that yet. And it looks like I hadn't seen that graph from the benchmark that OpenAI just released yesterday, I think, or a couple of days ago. But yeah, I mean, it's the same kind of thing. Right now, we don't have evidence that best of both worlds is working. We have AI exceeding the performance, which hopefully that's not going to be the way it rolls out. Pranav thinks it will, just so you know. So he and I have all these discussions. Of course, he's a computer scientist and I'm a physician. So we go at it. And I don't know who's going to be right here, but he still thinks the AI is going to win no matter what. We'll see.
He's much smarter than I am. I can say that. I've worked with him for years. But I'm an irrational optimist. I think there's got to be some secret sauce of us being able to leverage these things to really take it all to the next level. But I'll remain optimistic until hopefully some evidence backs me up a little bit on
I'm with
that.
you. Just so you know, I'm very much with you.
And a lot of people forget who don't come from medicine. Many of our patient visits start when you already have the diagnosis set, and there are guidelines that even get you to the right treatment. So, like, often that is the starting point. And I think a lot of people outside of medicine go, "Oh, the job is done if I have the diagnosis." And often that's the starting point. And so anyway, it will be fascinating to see how this evolves.
Well, thanks for another awesome conversation, Eric. Thanks for joining us. This was tremendous. I do encourage everyone to please pick up the book, Super Agers. You won't be disappointed. There's some pretty big insights in there that I think that are starting to touch on a theme that I think we're going to see a lot more of in the future, which is aging. Well, I liked your term welderly, because we're all going to get there someday soon. And in my case, more sooner than some others. But I do feel like understanding really where the truth lies amongst all the hype and the swirling, I think is critical here, and how AI is going to take us to that next stage.
No, thanks. Great to be with you both.